Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
I'm not hurry, but I ain't got much time.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Today we're going to focus on one of the difficult issues raised by the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370. As you probably know by now, the airliner has seemingly vanished without a trace in the middle of a flight earlier this month. It sparked fears of a sophisticated terrorist plot, worries about airline safety. It has set off an international search of thousands of miles of ocean, not to mention thousands of hours of news media speculation. But it has also set off a much quieter tragedy. It has pushed the loved ones of the 200-plus passengers and crew into an emotional limbo. And that caused us to consider that in this country alone, there are thousands of American families living with the uncertainty of having someone go missing. In fact, the FBI had over 600,000 missing person entries in 2013. Many of those cases never make the headlines. And we wanted to talk about what that's like for the families left behind. To talk about this, we've called upon Kelly Murphy. Her son Jason has been missing for 13 years. He was 19 years old and was last seen taking out the garbage, waiting for a lift to a part-time job. She's founded the group Project Jason, an organization that helps provide support and resources for families of missing persons. She's with us from Seattle. Ms. Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show, Michelle.
Also with us, Natalie Wilson. She is the co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation. That is also a group that brings awareness and support to families. She focuses on missing persons of color. Natalie Wilson, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Murphy, I have to say I'm so sorry that this has happened to you. I don't know how else to start.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It is hard to know what to say when someone's in this situation. It's just so unusual, and especially unusual to have it go on for such a period of time. And I know what those families of the missing passengers are experiencing right now, and it's just very traumatic.
And I know it's difficult, but can you tell us a little bit more about what happened to your son? As I understand it, he was just the last person to see him was his younger brother, your other son, Michael, who saw him taking the trash cans out, and he was waiting for a lift. What happened?
Well, we don't know what happened. Close to 13 years later, we still really don't know much more than what happened on that day. And that's that his car was in the shop getting repairs. He worked a part-time job in the afternoon, and they called him to work in early. We were at work, so we couldn't take him. They arranged to pick him up at a nearby high school, which was 7 blocks from the house. We were gone. He got ready for work. He did his chores. And then, presumably, he started that walk to the high school where he was going to be met by one of the employees to give him a lift to the job, and he never showed up. Mm-hmm. And it's such a mystery. We have no idea what happened. There are no leads, no clues, no suspects. It's just an everlasting limbo, a nightmare that you don't wake up from.
Forgive me for asking this question this way, because it sounds like such a stupid question, but what's the hardest part of this?
The hardest thing would be what I call living in the not knowing. It's living in this limbo of not knowing what has happened to someone that you love. You go to bed every night, and you don't know, is he warm? Is he safe? Has someone taken his life? You just simply don't know the answer. So you're living with what's called ambiguous loss without an answer. You can't move forward in the grieving process, which is usually what someone would do in a somewhat similar circumstance when they have answers. But we don't have answers.
Natalie Wilson, let me turn to you now. We've previously covered your organization, which started in part out of a concern that you and your co-founder, who works in law enforcement, had, that persons of color who are missing often don't get any attention from the media or in law enforcement or very little. And I'd like to just ask, just if you would chime in here and say how much of what Mrs. Murphy has experienced are the kinds of things that the families you work with have experienced.
Absolutely. Individuals that we help, they do not have any answers as to what happened to their missing loved one. And they're in pain, and they are looking for them. One mother said to me, I don't know if my daughter ate. I don't know if she's alive. I don't know if she's in the cold. I need to find her. And awareness is key in finding our missing. 40% of all persons missing are of color. Last year alone, there were more than 242,000 persons of color reported missing. And that's reported. I'm sure there are many who were not reported missing. And awareness is key in finding our missing. All of us have a responsibility, not only law enforcement, the media, but our community. We need to come forward if we have information about this individual, because families are looking for closure. They deserve answers as to what happened.
Can I ask, maybe I'll start with Mrs. Murphy, when you see the kind of attention being given to this airliner that seems to have disappeared, you know, of course that's a story. I mean, of course people are going to be interested in it. But does it make it, I don't know how to ask this, better or worse for you? I mean, is there a part of you that kind of resents the fact that people are still thinking, you know, day after day after day? Or do you see what I'm asking? When you see another story like this about somebody or something like this, how do you react to it?
I'm not resentful at all. It is a great tragedy. Multiple families are affected. We have 239 missing passengers, and you take that times, you know, who knows how many close friends and family. It's just a very wide circle of impact. So there's no resentment whatsoever. And they need to get to the bottom of this mystery. So perhaps the more people that are aware and continue to be aware of what they're finding, perhaps the mystery will be solved and the persons affected can find some sort of peace in whatever answer lies ahead for them.
Natalie Wilson, I know that your background is communication, so part of your expertise is trying to make sure that the public stays interested.
Right.
But could you just talk a little bit about, you know, how you do that and what toll this kind of thing takes on families? Okay.
Well, we also assist families in searching for their missing loved ones. And we have a number of partnerships. Again, awareness is key in finding our missing. We have created a support group. Normally, there's a support group for Alcohol Anonymous for victims of homicide. But when there's someone that is missing, it's not really considered a crime because law enforcement will say that individual could have walked away. So families, they need a shoulder to cry on. They may need to exchange information, exchange experiences. So we have created a support group listening from the families to help them get through this process.
Mrs. Murphy, I'm thinking that for myself, I think the hardest thing would be to try to figure out, on the one hand, you can't let this person go, because if you let this person go, who is going to keep looking for this person, right, for the loved one? On the other hand, you still have another child to raise. You still have the rest of your life to do. How do you go about balancing that?
You're absolutely right. There is a balance to be found, and sometimes it can take a while to strike that correct balance because no, you are the advocate for potentially the rest of your life for your missing loved one, and you need to be creative and keep thinking of ways to keep his story out there to make sure the public knows he's still missing. We need the public's eyes and the public's ears to help bring him home potentially. But there is a healthy balance between the search, that part of your life that is the ongoing search, the rest of your family and the relationships in your family and the balance there. And also for that person, the seeking person as an individual, it's a healthy thing to come back and find some hobbies that are fulfilling to you, whether those be old hobbies or new hobbies. So it's a healthy thing to find what that balance is. The search always remains a part of your life. But the reaction of trauma on the body and on the psyche, with that, you just need to have that healthy balance and to find things that fulfill you as an individual. And I can't emphasize that enough.
Do you still have hope that he is alive?
I have hope, yes. And I always tell the families that we work with, hope is your right until you know the truth. And it is our right to hope. And hope gives us insight into a future that we, again, hope is a good future.
Natalie, can you just give us a final thought about somebody who may be listening to our conversation and would like to be helpful, perhaps know someone in the situation who is in this limbo? What mm-hmm. can they do to be helpful?
Okay. We ask individuals just to be hopeful, to provide hope and love and support for families that are going through this. And we also speak to the minority community. We know that there's a sense of distrust with law enforcement, and there's this no snitching. If someone has any information about a missing person case, you can report it anonymously to law enforcement. You can report it anonymously to the Black and Missing Foundation, because these families deserve answers. They need to know what happened to their loved ones, and we need to just to bring them home. But again, someone may need a shoulder to cry on. They may need financial support. We're seeing where a number of individuals, they lose their job or their savings because they're looking or they're searching for their loved one. So whatever support that person needs, please be there to help them through this process.
Mrs. Murphy, final thought from you on that? Is there something that, and I hate, you know, I don't mean to put it into the negative, but sometimes, you know, is there one thing you really wish people would have done to help you or would do now to help you? Is there one thing you'd really wish people would not do to help this person in this situation?
Well, people, it's a frightening situation, so people don't know how to react and what to say to the person who is suffering this tragic loss. And I think in our logical minds, when someone says something like that to us, we understand they don't understand. And it's hard, but we can shrug it off. So we don't want anyone to be in our shoes. We're glad they're not in our shoes. And we just keep going, take one step at a time, one day at a time. Sometimes it's 1 minute at a time, similar to what the families of the passengers are going through right now, just hoping and waiting for those answers, and that answers will come.
Well, we can keep a good thought for you and for Jason as well.
Well, thank you so much.
That was Kelly Murphy, founder of Project Jason. It's a support group for families with a missing loved one, named in honor of her son, Jason, who has been missing for more than 12 years now. We reached her in Seattle, Washington. Also with us in Washington, D.C., Natalie Wilson, the co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, new research shows that Black boys are routinely seen as older than they really are and older than their white and Latino peers. We'll talk with one of the researchers who explains why that matters and that there's nothing cute about it.
When adults see children, we see people that are in need of protection. When we see adults, we don't feel that same kind of need.
One of the authors of the study, The Essence of Innocence, is just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, a voice lesson from Delora Zajic, who has sung with the Met for 25 years. She's also the founder and director of the Institute for Young Dramatic Voices for young singers with big or unusual voices. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the Hilton Garden Inn, Champaign-Urbana, located right off the corner of Neal and Kirby. Hilton Garden offers in-room Keurig coffee makers, refrigerators, and Wi-Fi with 18,000 square feet of convention space. Full details on accommodation, amenities, and banquet services can be found at hiltongardeninn3.hilton.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're going to spend the next part of the program talking about some new conversations people are having about the way we look and talk about kids, both boys and girls. In a few minutes, we'll dip into the debate over whether we should stop calling some girls bossy, as Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg suggests we should. She says it dampens girls' desire for leadership. We're going to have a variety of opinions about that. But first, we're going to take a closer look at some new research about the way some boys are viewed by adults. This work was recently published in the Journal of Personal personality and social psychology, and it found that African-American boys as young as 10 years old were significantly less likely to be viewed as children than their white peers. The report suggests that this could have serious implications for the way African-American boys are viewed by the criminal justice system and by society as a whole. The title of that report is The Essence of Innocence: Consequences of Dehumanizing Black Children. Philip Atiba Goff is one of the lead authors of that research. He's also an assistant professor of social psychology at UCLA, and he's with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
What inspired you to take a look at this issue? What made you think about this?
Well, having been a young black man myself, having grown up in integrated spaces, I have had a chance to see the ways in which young black men get treated differently. But I have to say what inspired me to do this research in particular was research that had been done previously showing that black boys in particular are seen as older than they are, and seeing the ways in which black boys get treated differently in the criminal justice system. For instance, that black boys are 18 times more likely to be tried as adults than are white boys.
For the same offenses?
For the exact same offenses, that's right.
So how did you go about studying this question or framing this question?
Well, we started simple and then got more complex. We first just showed people pictures of boys of various ages and of various races and asked them to guess how old they were. But as we kept going, we said in a criminal justice context where this matters the most, they would have information about something that the boy was suspected of. So we had them suspected of misdemeanors, and we described the misdemeanor, like vandalism or getting into a scuffle at school, or they were suspected of felonies, like car theft or something like that. We had them that next to the picture and just asked people, how old does this person look? And replicating previous work by Sandra Graham, Brian Lowry, Jennifer Eberhardt, other folks who had found similar kinds of things, people saw the black children as much older than the white children of the same age suspected of the same crime.
At what age does this effect start to be seen? How young can a boy be before he starts to be seen as older than he really is?
So there's some converging evidence that it starts around the age that puberty starts. So at the onset of teenage years and adolescence, that's about as early as it can start. And then obviously by the time that folks get to adulthood, then everybody gets seen kind of the same way.
What do you think are the consequences of this kind of perception gap?
Well, I can think about right now my godchildren who are very excited to be thought of as older than they are. Every kid can't wait to become an adult. But here I think the consequences are much less innocent and endearing than that. When adults see children, we see people that are in need of protection, people that we want to help and keep separate from the worst that society has to do. When we see adults, we don't feel that same kind of need. And when we rob children of that protection of childhood, then they can be treated like adults in the criminal justice system. They can be punished more harshly. They can be given less of the benefit of the doubt. We try less hard to help them understand their mistakes. And we believe less that they can, over time, fix their mistakes. So all of the good things we want to give to children are taken early from black children, and that can't happen.
You call the study dehumanizing black children. Why is it? I'm curious about why you call it dehumanizing black children as opposed to simple bias. I mean, why is this not just prejudice against black people?
Well, when we think about childhood, the essence of childhood is that children need to be protected, at least in the modern U.S. And there's a long line of literature showing that. When we see people as children, but all of a sudden they don't need to be protected, we're removing basic human considerations from them. And that's what we found throughout our study. So the first set, and I think the set of studies that are getting the most attention out of this, are the age overestimation stuff. But the stuff that's at the back end of this paper, we show that people think of childhood as a less essential category when they're thinking of childhood as something that black children have as opposed to white children. That's a form of dehumanization when you're taking basic human protections away. Prejudice is just, I don't like you. Dehumanization is, I can do things to you that I can't do to other people that are in the human family.
I'm thinking that people who follow these kinds of stories can think of a number of examples where this issue might have come into play. But I think the issue around the treatment of a minor that is on a lot of people's minds, if they know no other examples, would be the Trayvon Martin case.
Yes.
Is this an example of that, in your opinion?
Well, so the scientist in me says it always depends. I can't tell you what was in George Zimmerman's mind. I wasn't there. I don't know what happened that night. But certainly in the way that that case played out in public, we saw instances of it where all of a sudden a 17-year-old boy was portrayed as a manly thug. He was seen sometimes by people to be older than he actually was. He was a boy in a man's body, was something I heard multiple times. And you don't hear that when it's white children in the same kind of context.
It's interesting because I think the flip side of this is I think there will be some people who would argue that black boys do act older or are tougher. And so I want to know if there's any evidence of that, or even if it's an interactive phenomenon where people treat them as they're older so that they act older.
So that's a great question. And as the scientist, again, I have to say it depends. But I think there's a way to think about it slightly differently. Not that, well, they're treated as older because they deserve it. Think about a young boy at his bar mitzvah or at a high school graduation when they're still 17 or at prom or at a public speaking event. When that's a white boy in a suit, acting as an adult, doing a wonderful job, parents and friends think about, my goodness, how grown up you can act. Which means there are situations that cause individuals to act like adults before they are adults. We train people into being adults. In black boys' lives, what we know from developmental psychology is there are more situations that demand that they be adults than there are in the average white boy's lives. Not everybody, not every black child has this, but on average, more black boys get asked to be in more situations where they're acting like adults than white boys. And the problem is we rarely see our black children with the basic human privilege of getting to act like children.
I know that a lot of your research was done with police officers, mostly white police officers, to test their perceptions of black children as well as their overall propensity toward bias, right? To have negative views of black people in general, as well as to test their perceptions of black children per se. I am curious to know whether black police officers demonstrated the same pattern of misperception of black children's ages and the same patterns of bias that you determined?
That's a great question. So let me answer a question I think is embedded within that first, which is that we weren't looking to see if police officers were especially likely to show these biases, but to see what the consequences were. So police officers, unfortunately, are from the human family. They have the same biases in this case as the undergraduate university students and the lay public that we surveyed. I wish we had more black police officers in our study because then I could give you a good answer. But because we had so few, we weren't able to see whether there were large differences between them. And that's certainly what some follow-up research we hope will take a look at.
What would you hope to happen as a result of this research?
Well, again, this research is about translating previous findings from the laboratory to the world. And so both the purpose of the Center for Policing Equity and my particular research lab is to kind of export, to give away the findings of social psychology to the places where the consequences are most dire. So what we're hoping to do is to find interventions that will reduce this disparity. So, for instance, if officers ask the age of the person that they're stopping or they're talking to, maybe they can remember, oh, this is a human child. At 16 and at 15, they may look like an adult to me. My mind may see them as a threatening individual for all kinds of reasons, but let me help them to stay a child. Also, I think it makes sense that we all have this perception because when you said, you know, in general, people think that they act that way, and that's why we treat them that way. And if that makes sense, then we need to change the ways in which we portray black men and boys. We need to portray black boys in the state of childhood so that we can protect them in that state and keep them in that state before the early onset of adulthood that all parents fear for their kids.
Can I ask you, since we started our conversation talking about part of it is your own experience of the world, when you saw this research, when you started digging deeply into this research, do you mind if I asked how it made you feel?
Well, most of the research that I am most proud of has this kind of dual effect on me, where I'm happy to know so that we can do something about it, and I am distressed that we didn't know earlier. Because it means that we're just starting some of these things now. And I think that's the conundrum of living in contemporary American democracy, is that we've come so far with so far to go. There's so many challenges we haven't met. And that can be distressing or inspiring, depending on the mood that you're in when it hits you. And it usually hits me in both moods.
Philip Atiba Goff is an assistant professor of social psychology at UCLA. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Again, thanks for having me.
Now we're going to focus on a debate over how we talk about women in leadership, or let's say leaders in training. We're talking about the Ban Bossy campaign by Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg. Now, Sheryl Sandberg previously stirred the pot on the whole issue of women's place in public life with her 2013 book, Encouraging Women to Lean Into Their Careers. In her latest campaign, Sandberg is fighting to ban bossy. She's telling people to stop using that word and others like it to describe assertive girls. Sandberg recently talked about that with NPR's Melissa Block.
Bossy is one of the many ways we discourage girls from leading. When a little boy leads, it's expected. We applaud him. But when girls lead, we call them bossy. We tell them not to. We tell them to put down their hands. And we do this in very explicit ways and very implicit ways.
But just like Sandberg's lean in, her ban bossy effort has sparked a backlash, or at least a spirited critique, including by writer Margaret Talbot. She wrote the essay Don't Ban Bossy for The New Yorker, and Margaret Talbot is with us now. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
I'd just like to mention we're going to hear from a number of other commentators about this in our roundtable in just a few minutes. But first, let's hear from you. What's your main criticism of banning bossy?
Well, for one thing, I think bossy is a perfectly good word. It actually describes behavior that I think we've all seen and experienced and can be kind of annoying in boys or girls. Now, it is true, and I think this is good that they called attention to this, that we probably use it more often to talk about little girls and girls maybe in general. But it's also true that there are people who they aren't your boss, but they're acting kind of bossy. You know, they're telling you what to do. They're offering unsolicited advice, right? And that's bossy. That's not the same as leadership. It's a particular human trait.
But why do you think it is that it is more often applied to girls?
Well, it might be that historically, because girls and women haven't had authority but have wanted to exert it, that they haven't been the bosses but have wanted to be bossy. So, you know, have wanted to exercise leadership. So it could be that historically that's the reason. I also think there are certain words that, you know, there are certain words we use mainly when we're talking about boys and men, too, which are also negative words, like jerk is a word you don't usually call a girl a jerk. And, you know, one of the points I wanted to make in the piece is that a good, I think, way to react to these words is sometimes just to try and reclaim them and use them for your own purposes, like gay rights advocates did with the word queer, for example. Or, and this seemed like a good precedent, the word nerd. When I was growing up, it was really about boys, and it was really a put down, and it was, you know, the boys with the pocket protectors and the calculators and the chess club. And now, you know, girls and boys call themselves nerds, often call themselves that, you know, kind of proudly. Adults call themselves that when they're calling attention to some expertise or passion of theirs. You know, I'm an ethnic food nerd, or I'm a Jane Austen nerd, or whatever. So I think you can sort of reclaim these words, and that's a more creative, probably more long-term solution.
A number of accomplished women have signed on to ban bossy, including the former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, the Girl Scouts CEO Ana Maria Chavez. I'm wondering what you think these women are attracted to in signing on to this, and if there's something wrong with it. I mean, if you think there's something wrong with the campaign.
Well, I think really it's not that there's something wrong with the campaign, although I don't like the idea of banning words unless they're truly only used to demean or degrade people, which I don't think we can say about the word bossy. But, you know, I think that actually a better way is to think about just promoting and encouraging leadership in girls, which is something that, for example, the Girl Scouts organization does very well already by teaching girls, you know, competencies in a wide range of organizational activities. And, you know, I think by encouraging girls, there are studies that show that parents encouraging girls to think about running for office, for example, makes a big difference. Participating in sports makes a big difference because it really encourages girls to sort of feel and you know, be proud of being competitive, which politics, for example, is something that demands. So I think there are other ways that are a little less gimmicky and a little more straightforward to encourage leadership in girls.
Why do you think these high-profile women are attracted to this?
It's kind of cute. It's kind of catchy. You know, it's alliterative, ban bossy. And I think a lot of women probably have had the experience of feeling that their leadership skills are being kind of downplayed or they're being patronized for them. So they may be getting at a real issue. It's just I don't think it's the best way to go about it.
Have you ever been called bossy?
Probably by my kids. Yeah, I probably have. Because, you know,
you're not
all
the
moms,
boss of me.
Yeah, right.
You're not
all
the
moms
boss
are
of
bossy.
Me, Margaret.
But not in a long time. But, you know, I
when
think...
When you were growing up.
But when I was growing up, not so much. I'm the youngest in my family. I'm sure I called my older siblings bossy.
Were you trying to be mean? Do you remember whether you called... I don't know if you have older sisters or brothers. I know you have a brother.
I have an older sister and two older brothers, yeah.
Do you ever remember thinking of more than one or the other as being more bossy?
Ooh, that's tricky. Sorry, Cindy, but yeah, my sister was the bossier one.
She was the bossier one.
But you know, she's a doctor. She's a kind of a knowledgeable person. So maybe she was just, you know, showing that off.
Showing that off.
Yeah.
What reaction are you getting to the piece?
You know, I've gotten positive reaction. And in fact, people have been citing different words and terms like sassy. I had a linguist friend who wrote in about sassy. She said when she was younger, she's in her 40s now, sass was a bad word. It was like something when you talk back to your parents, you know, or your teachers. Now people, women kind of like to be called sassy, right? So it's sort of an example of a word that people have reclaimed. And, you know, Tina Fey has done it with bossy, bossy pants, her book.
Margaret, you're so bossy. Margaret Talbot is a writer for The New Yorker. She joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
You know what? We're kind of bossy, so just ahead, we're going to keep the conversation going on Sheryl Sandberg's latest quest to ban bossy when referring to assertive girls.
Dare to be you.
You can change the world.
Let's ban bossy.
Be brave. Be you.
I'm not bossy. I'm the boss.
High-profile women like pop star Beyoncé and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are on board with the campaign, but will our beauty shop panel sign on? We'll ask. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young, next time on Here and Now.
This is Piers Morgan Live, breaking news tonight. A Malaysia Airlines plane carrying 239 people bound for Beijing is missing.
The disappearance of Malaysian Flight 370 has captured the world's attention. What is the inescapable pull? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
I'm Diane Nolan, host of Mid-American Gardener. Join me this October on a bus trip to explore the Arkansas gardens of PBS host P. Allen Smith. We'll tour the grounds, enjoy a farm-to-table lunch, and we might even receive a visit from Allen himself. We'll also stop in Memphis and experience Beale Street. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or go to will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we're going to head into the beauty shop. That's what we call our conversations with a panel of women commentators and journalists. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Connie Schultz, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and author of And His Lovely Wife, a memoir from the woman beside the man. Kelly Goff is back with us. She's a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. Bridget Johnson is back with us. She's the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian news and commentary site. And new to this shop, but not to NPR, is my colleague Michelle Norris. She is a special correspondent for NPR and curator and founder of The Race Card Project. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here.
Greetings.
So let's start where the previous conversation left off and talk about Sheryl Sandberg's campaign to ban the word bossy when referring to girls. Sandberg says that she wants to change perceptions about assertive girls and women like Condoleezza Rice. The fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg and even Beyoncé have endorsed the idea.
Let's ban bossy. Be brave. Be you. I'm not bossy. I'm the boss.
Well, we just heard from Margaret Talbert of The New Yorker. She wrote about this. Not everybody is jumping on the ban bossy bandwagon. So we wanted to get a few more ideas about this from this distinguished panel. And you can tell us whether you're bossy or not. So Connie Schultz, let me start with you. You wrote about this for Parade magazine. What's your take?
Well, I did because I'm the oldest of four. And I was raised to be in charge of my siblings, so bossy was a positive job review in our family. But I did also quote Lucille Clifton, the poet, who said, what they call you is one thing. What you answer to is something else, which I think goes to the heart of this campaign. I'm not as concerned about what women are called. I mean, I've been called far worse than bossy because I'm a female columnist, right? But it is important that you not let it get in your head. You know, figuring out who we are is an inside job. It has to be. And I think that probably is the bigger point. I certainly can hear the pushback, which I wasn't exactly expecting, but it's making sense as I hear it.
So Kelly Goff, you also wrote about this. You wrote this for The Daily Beast. Can I just quote just a couple lines?
Sure.
When I look at the laundry list of obstacles that women face, particularly those of us who do not come from privileged backgrounds, being called bossy doesn't rank in the top 20. And as you're kind of co-signing Connie here, for the record, I've been called much, much worse. Any female blogger or television pundit has. But I actually credit the fact that I was called bossy, talkative, and mouthy regularly as a child and had parents who encouraged me to embrace such labels to playing a key role in the fact that I'm rarely offended by the names I get called when I write a column that someone hates today. So pick it up from there.
Well, yeah, it's funny because as you and a lot of people know, because I talk about her so much, my mom is sort of my final editor in that I always sort of run column ideas by her. And when I told her I was planning to write about this, she said, well, I get called bossy all the time. I just always took it as a compliment. And that, I think, sort of speaks to how I was raised and why I sort of don't relate to the fact that this is the most lethal, deadly, harmful thing that a girl can be called. I also, though, I want to say that going back to the larger issue, really, that I had with this whole campaign, it sort of reminds me, Michelle, as a New York voter, if someone were to say to me, what do you think are the most important issues facing New York? I'd say, you know, the housing crisis, education crisis, economic inequality. And if someone said to me, well, what about picking up after your pets? Don't you think that's a big issue, littering and people picking up after their pets? I'd say, well, sure. But if they said, is that what you want the mayor focusing on? I'd probably say, not really. And that's what this sort of feels like to me. Sheryl Sandberg is one of the most influential women on the planet, not just our country, but on the planet. And when I think of all the obstacles facing women and girls in this country, it's a bummer to me that this is sort of the one that she picked up as like the defining issue, when particularly for low-income girls, that's definitely not the case.
Michelle Norris, a lot of women of color who are writing about this have said the word bossy can be a badge of honor for black and brown girls. It's just like Kelly just said. So what are your thoughts about this? And also if people on your Race Card Project are weighing in on this, too, I'd be interested.
You know, people talk about perceptions of women sometimes and how certain words are attached to women like bossy or the word shrill, which is never really attached to a man. But when I think about this, much like Kelly and Connie, I think about the woman that I was raised by and how they were bossy and they owned it. It was a badge of honor for them. And they passed that, I think, on to their daughters and the women in my family. I mean, Sheryl Sandberg has done some wonderful things with Lean, and particularly speaking up in boardrooms where women are so grossly underrepresented. But this one is curious to me, because if you want young women to be bossy or to be bosses, they have to be willing to be bossy. And maybe instead of band bossy, it should be plan bossy. If you want to be in a leadership role, you know, you have to use a full palette of leadership skills. And sometimes that calls for grace, and sometimes it calls for grit, sometimes a high hand, sometimes a light touch. But trust me, if you want to be the boss, there's going to be a moment where you will have to be bossy.
Are you seeing any racial difference in center of gravity on this? Sometimes there are. I mean, I've heard from a lot of women of color who say, I wish bossy was the worst thing that I've ever been called. I wish. Whereas other people are saying that they do feel that, particularly for very young girls, this can really be a crushing thing and we should take it seriously. Are you seeing any center of gravity around this that has a kind of a racially different feel?
I think it's cultural, perhaps, that in some places there's an expectation that if you are going to be heard, if you are going to be respected, if you are going to be embraced, you have to speak up because you're not necessarily going to be called on. And so there are young women who are encouraged or who are applauded for speaking up because that's accepted. And Sheryl Sandberg writes about her own experience. She cringes when she thinks about the little bossy girl she used to be. And that's perhaps maybe because it wasn't encouraged in the circle that she grew up in, that someone was maybe looking at her and saying, you don't want to be that bossy. It's my experience that a lot of women grow up in communities where they are expected to amplify their voice, if not necessarily to talk loudly, but to make sure that their presence is felt because otherwise they might be ignored. Invisible is a word that comes up a lot in the Race Car Project.
Michelle?
Let's get Bridget Johnson in this, and then we can hear again from you. Bridget Johnson, what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I really like Kelly's piece that actions speak louder than words in this. I can relate to Connie's piece about getting steamrolled in the newsroom if you're not assertive enough. You know, I think back to my first supervisory position in newsroom was when I was 24. And so I was supposed to be telling guys, you know, twice my age what to do, and that didn't go over well. And at first, you know, I was sort of the mind, let's sort of smooth things out. But then at a point you get to, you know, okay, I'm tired of this. We have a paper to get out. Cut the attitude. You know, no drama. Let's move on. So I think that it can be a disservice to girls moving up the career ladder if they're not taught some sort of decorum about assertiveness. You think of, like, you know, resumes that might come on your desk where the cover letter just oozes the bossy gene instead of just applying this assertiveness at the correct time. And you think, this is a person who, you know, I like an aggressive reporter, but not one who's going to fight me on, you know, taking direction every single step of the way.
But that's not a, is that male or female? Is that a particular problem with male or female
resumes? I've
seen both.
Yeah.
Right. Can I throw one other idea out here? I tell you, the thing that was, I was struggling to figure out what is it that bothers me. You know, you've identified a lot of the things that I was thinking about, but part of what bothers me, well, three things bother me. One is, you know, if this is yet another thing that's going to get kids sent to the principal's office, I know who's going to get sent to the principal's office more often. And it's going to be that black and brown boy. Thing one. The other thing that bothers me about it is it implies that the male model of leadership is the one that we're supposed to aspire to, right? That's the part I don't. So maybe men could stand to be less bossy or less jerky, or maybe they could stand to learn from things that are traditionally associated with female styles of leadership, which is an appreciation for collaboration and respect. So that's part of what annoys me about it. I can't remember the third at the moment. So Kelly, why don't you tell me what else is on your mind?
But I was going to jump in too and say that I thought, speaking back earlier to the question you asked Margaret about why is this the campaign that everyone's jumping on? And I think part of it is because it seems like the most innocuous sounding, right? That politically speaking, it's like the least dangerous form of sort of kind of tiptoeing around feminism, right? To say, I want to empower girls and women. It's not exactly a feminist movement, but we're going to ban bossy. And I think that perhaps was sort of Sheryl's goal. Like, how can I look like I'm doing something without doing something that actually does so much that it's controversial? And I think that that's also what's frustrating, right? Because she has this amazing this amazing platform, and it's just it's like I said, it's a little bit of a disappointment to see it. But the last thing I wanted to say too, Michelle, is I do think that in addition to culture, there's a real class element here that we're sort of dancing around. In that in the black community, a lot of women have been heads of households for generations, and so this idea that that we have to struggle to find our voice as leaders is a little silly to us. And the fact that that would be our biggest problem is even sillier. And so that's kind of the bit of a disconnect. As I referenced in my piece, you know, they're coaching women at Harvard Business School on how to raise their hands. I wish that was my biggest problem in life when I was trying to figure out how to finance my education. I wish that was my biggest concern.
What you said about that, you said this in your piece, and I think, you know, why don't we just say what you said, which is you said, look, if Sheryl Sandberg really wants to impact gender equality, here's a novel idea, write a check. Actually, don't write one or two or three or four. How about putting a post on Facebook asking every single bossy girl who has the grades and ambition to go to college but isn't sure she can afford it to message you and then offer to pay for her to go with no loans, particularly if she's pursuing a STEM field. So, you know, so what you're saying is, yeah, let's do more than sort of talk. Connie, you had one more thought?
What this reminds me of is the other B word that I won't say, of course, but that I suspect all of us, if we've been in leadership roles, have been called it on occasion. And it reminds me of my favorite T-shirt. I still own it. It is so threadbare. And it said simply, that's Ms. B to you. And it was such a wonderful thing to wear until my children could read.
But guess what? Arcs could read too. If you're just joining us, we're in the Beauty Shop. We're catching up on this week's buzzy topics with NPR's Michelle Norris, commentators Kelly Goff, Connie Schultz, and Bridget Johnson. Moving on, I wanted to ask you all about this new documentary called Anita that focuses on Anita Hill, the woman who accused Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas of sexually harassing her when she worked for him in two different positions. And she testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee at Thomas's confirmation hearing back in 1991. And this is something that sparked a huge debate about sexual harassment. And it was just top of the news for a minute there. And now it's interesting that it's, you know, we've come full circle. I mean, I remember covering this. I remember the phone call that I got at home from a source telling me that something was happening with this confirmation hearing that was supposed to just kind of sail right through. And then, so I wanted to ask, Michelle, maybe you want to start this off. Did this change the conversation around these issues?
It changed the conversation in so many ways. I mean, I remember in 1991 that there were a lot of women who were concerned that it would make it harder for women who had experienced sexual harassment to step out of the shadows. They thought it would have a chilling effect.
Why?
And in fact, well, that because she was placed, you know, remember the picture. She was sitting at this table facing this phalanx of senators all by herself. That women would look at that and think, how will I ever raise my hand if this is what I might be subjected to? And exactly the opposite happened. I mean, at the EEOC, where Clarence Thomas once worked, the number of sexual harassment claims doubled. Women stepped out of the shadows. Women started talking about it. And laws changed, and companies changed. I mean, most of us now, if you work for a corporation, you probably have to go through mandatory sexual harassment training to indemnify the company, the mandatory training that you have to go through. That is a direct result of the conversations that changed. So it changed in lots of different ways. It changed in a personal way. It changed in sort of small private spaces, but it also changed in the chambers of you know, where laws are made, and it also changed in the corporate structure. It had a wide-ranging effect.
Yeah, Kelly, though, it's interesting that I also remember even at the time a kind of I don't remember, was it a racial divide or was it a gender divide among African Americans? I'm not even sure that's even accurate. I know that there was just a lot of really intense debate around whether she was undermining him, whether it was she was being disloyal, whether she should have kept her mouth shut, even if it was true. I don't know. What are your thoughts about this now?
Well, I think that I'm not going to say my age, but I don't remember it that well through the eyes of when I was much younger. But here's what I do know, echoing what Michelle said, it has completely changed the landscape for women of my generation, because I know for a fact that if something was done to my mother, there was not the recourse that those of my generation feel exist. Right. And that is a direct result of Anita Hill. The fact that Bob Packwood was sent packing from the Senate, that's a direct result of Anita Hill. So for me, she's a shero, because she rewrote the rules for those of us who are now in the workplace. And I tip my hat to her for that. What I kind of think about, though, and this is a little esoteric, is I do wonder how differently things would have played out in the age of social media and in the age of email, right? Like how, because she was so discredited at that time, and yet so much of it was later proved to at least be substantiated. Not, you know, whether or not all the allegations, but much of it was substantiated. We know the bizarre phone call later from Justice Thomas's wife. But I just really wonder how different things would have been had, you know, sort of some of the paper trail and documentation we have today existed.
Bridget, what do you think about this? I know that conservatives still see a double standard in the way that these kinds of accusations are handled. And I just wonder if you feel that way, too. They feel that, you know, liberals get a pass by and large, although I don't know that you can say that Bill Clinton got a pass. But they think, some people think he did. And they feel that conservatives come in for sort of particular scrutiny on these issues. What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, Anthony Weiner didn't get a pass. I was in high school at the time of the hearing. All I remember was the sensational aspect of it. I remember pubic hairs on Coke cans and how we'd laugh about that in my history class. I think that one of the lessons that needs to come out of looking back on those hearings for girls, for women who at some point want to come forward with a sexual harassment allegation, is to just bear in mind that this is not necessarily indicative of what happens to you in a judicial setting. This was a congressional committee with none of those rules, you know, regarding evidence and witnesses, and there was politics seeping from every single corner. And another lesson is keep every bit of evidence that you can, so that you do have a paper trail and it doesn't turn into he said, she said.
Important point. Okay, Connie Schultz, what about you?
I can't overstate the personal impact it had on me. I will say my age. I'm 56. I'm a year younger, almost to the day, than Anita Hill. And I was a stay-at-home mom working as a freelancer in a very difficult marriage, scared out of my mind about what would come next, heading 2 years later into a male-dominated newsroom. Watching this young African-American woman, and I do think her race was so important in that when you look at the images, even in the trailer, of this panel of mostly older, well, all men, white males, most of them much older, you know, staring down at her, and watching her hold her own through this was so inspiring to me. And, you know, I think most of us could name a few women we've looked at over the years when we were having those moments. Can we do this? Mm-hmm. Can we step out of this, whatever mess we're in? Watching her, I'm inspired all over again watching her, even in the trailer. And I'll probably be writing about the documentary. Mm-hmm. I think what saddens me is the beginning of that trailer and all those young women who have never heard of her.
Well, we'll see. I mean, they will now. They will now. And I'll be interested what your daughters, once the movie comes out with a film, what your daughters think of it. Michelle, final thought from you, just 10 seconds.
Well, I was thinking about daughters. And one of the things that struck me in the film is she talked about the impact of how many daughters tapped on the shoulder of their fathers and said, I have had a similar experience, or I'm worried about this. And that had an impact on what actually happened following that testimony.
Or how many women tapped on the shoulders of their bosses to said, oh, by the way, I've had this experience and you don't know about it, and let me tell you. Kelly Goff is a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast with us from our bureau in New York. Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist. She joined us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Bridget Johnson is Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. She and Michelle Norris, special correspondent for NPR, curator and founder of the Race Card Project, both joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.